Today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show, you're going to want to hang on to your wallets because we're going to be talking about a lot of Kickstarters, a lot of products, a lot of really good deals that you can get in the world of tabletop role-playing games today. We have a couple of really interesting community highlights. We're going to talk about Robert Schwab's interview on La Taberna de Roll. We have DM David talking about Daggerheart versus the MCDM RPG versus D&D. And today's big topic is going to be on why we split up the components of our prep when we are following the steps from Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master. All on the Lazy RPG Talk Show. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in tabletop role-playing games. This show is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. The patrons get access to a dedicated Discord server, the monthly Q&A, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, the City of Arches Sourcebook, a bunch of exclusive adventures, and a whole ton of cool digital tools to help you build your games and learn more about the games that we love. It is a really, really good deal to sign up for the Patreon of Sly Flourish. And to the patrons of Sly Flourish, thank you so much for your support. I did not have a show last week, which means I've been capturing links to interesting things that I have been discovering over the past couple of weeks in the world of tabletop role-playing games. I've been collecting them in my Notion notes so that we can talk about them here on the show. But I will tell you this, if you are listening to the podcast or if you're watching the YouTube video, you probably want to jump right into the show notes and take a look at the list of links because there's a whole bunch of different things there. I'm going to capture all of the links to all these topics in there, but it's going to be outstanding. So this is sort of a little bit of a link dump of different stuff that has occurred. Over on the Spanish tabletop role-playing show called La Taberna, I'm going to totally mispronounce this and I apologize, La Taberna de Roll, a excellent podcast, Spanish-speaking podcast. I was on it. My friend Teo Sabadilla was on it. And Robert Schwab is on it. Robert Schwab is talking about Shadow of the Demon Lord on here, Shadow of the Weird Wizard. I think this was, the show only came out a month ago, but it sounds like the interview actually happened quite a while ago because it talks about Shadow of the Weird Wizard as though the Kickstarter has just been running and not with all of the most recent stuff that's happened with Shadow of the Weird Wizard. It is fascinating. Robert Schwab has been deeply involved in the world of D&D and tabletop role-playing games for decades, and he was involved in 3rd edition, he was involved in 4th edition, he was involved in 5th edition, he was involved, and then he wrote he separated himself out and went and did Shadow of the Demon Lord. Fantastic designer, incredible writer, just writes tons and tons of stuff for RPG products. He's one of the most prolific writers in tabletop role-playing games, and he has lots of interesting things to say about how 5th edition came to pass. He's got lots of little inside tidbits that I've not heard anywhere else about how they designed monsters, how they figured out the math for the game, what the modularity was supposed to be for 5th edition compared to what the modularity ended up actually being. It is an outstanding podcast. It's really interesting to hear his take on it and hear his take on Shadow the Demon Lord and Shadow the Weird Wizard, as well as his stuff from 5th edition. So take a look at that. And you can find that in the show notes. It's a really, if you want a little bit more inside baseball about 5th edition, how it came to be, what's going on in the inside, it's really, really outstanding. Now, Robert's work on 5th edition ended during the playtest. So he's not connected to anything that's happened recently, the direction that it's gone after the great big explosion of 5e and all of that. But if you want to hear it, it's really good. It is not in Spanish. It's actually in English with Spanish subtitles. So they did this show. They mix between going Spanish and English, but for this one, it is an English show with Spanish subtitles. So check that out. It was really, really excellent. DM David, my good friend David Hartledge over at DM David, has a really interesting article about comparing Daggerheart to MCDM's role-playing game to D&D, having actually played all three. Now, it's a really good article, and I highly recommend it. I love blog articles like this. It's a really great way to handle it, a really great way to kind of get into this topic. And the only one stipulation I would make is that during the time after he wrote this and before I talked about it, Daggerheart already came out with a new playtest version that has significantly changed a lot of the things in the book. So it's really interesting. They came out with a really high quality playtest for Daggerheart, and a lot of people had lots of comments on it, and they took those comments and they apparently changed a whole bunch. I have not playtested it. Honestly, these days I don't playtest very much. I haven't really been playtesting. I did a little bit of playtesting of the 2024 revision playtest list that Wizards of the Coast put out. But I kind of got tired of that too, because things would change all the time. And, you know, it's going to change whatever direction it changes, regardless of the feedback that I've got. So I didn't really see a lot of effort in playtesting. And now these days, I'd much rather play finished material than I would. My time with my friends is very valuable. I don't want to waste it on game material that hasn't yet gone through significant design. I applaud those that playtested and offer feedback. That is obviously very valuable. I am apparently selfish and selfish for my group and would like to play stuff after it's been playtested. So I haven't tried Daggerheart. I haven't tried the MCDM RPG as well, but lots of people have. Lots of people are very excited. And if you want to hear about some of the core ideas that go behind the mechanics of these two different, very different RPGs, three different, very different RPGs, Daggerheart, MCDM, and D&D, 5th edition, really. This article by DM David is an excellent article. I highly recommend it. You can find it, of course, in the show notes. All right. Here's where we're going to hang on to our wallets, because we got a lot of really cool projects that are going out on Kickstarter, various crowdfunding campaigns, and really good deals. The first one is the Wandering Tavern Kickstarter. This is by Homie and the Dude. I have been on their podcast. They're an excellent couple of folks. They have made a couple of products at this point that have been delivered and are excellent quality products, and they have created the Wandering Tavern. The Wandering Tavern is a floating... I love this idea of a... setting. So it's not an adventure, really. It's a setting. And the setting is built in a focused area. I am doing something very similar with the City of Arches. I did something very similar with Ruins of the Grendelroot, on the idea of like building a setting that is agnostic to the bigger setting that you set it in. So you can kind of put this in other worlds. You can take this idea and move it into whatever your own campaign setting, your own larger campaign setting or whatever. You have this fixed focused location, but you can use that location for lots of internal adventures and things like that. And in this one, it is a large floating city, a whole city that's held up by balloons and zeppelins and has big fans kind of pushing it around. And the whole setting is built on this one location. It's got, and you can take a look at the Kickstarter. One thing I will applaud, I always applaud this, the one-click sample. If you're running a Kickstarter and you really want to get my attention, I have one thing that I hang on to a lot, which is, show me a sample of the product that you're making. If you can show me a sample of the product with a single click, you get a big bonus star for me. If I don't have one, it's hard, because then, like, am I basing it on what I know about you? Do I know what it's going to look like? I'll give you another dirty trick about this whole thing. When I see a company, when I see even a small publisher, even if it's just a couple of guys that are making a product, when I see a sample that's already laid out, that already has some level of editing, that already has art dropped in there, what I'm seeing is a small version of the larger product. And that means they know how to make it. Sometimes I will go and I will not see a sample. And then the question is, do I know? Like, I'm a publisher as well. I publish material. And I can tell you that writing something isn't the hard part. Producing the product is the hard part. And that production means layout, editing, art, design. It means all of those things put together into some kind of product. And if I know you can do all of that for 12 pages, or in this case, 26 pages, then I know that you could probably do it for a couple of hundred pages. Because it seems like, oh, well, you know, it'd be that much harder. Well, once you've got the layout set, once you've got an editor on board, once you've got good artwork, once I know that you've got that flow going, then I recognize that the money that you're going to get for a Kickstarter is likely to help you build out the rest of it. I try to do that when I make my own. Like, if you look back at all of the Kickstarters I've run, we have laid out, edited samples with artwork, because we went through that extra effort ahead of time. Now, that costs money too. And then some small publishers say, hey, my whole point is I need the money in order to afford art and editing and layout. I get it. But some of these projects, you're going to have to put some money up front if you want to get something far enough along that you then can ask for a larger amount of money to get the full product done. Homie and the Dude have done that, and they've done that with this Kickstarter. You've got, you know, nice layout. You know what it's going to look like. It gives you a whole set about what the setting is like, history and lore of the setting, shows you the kind of artwork you're going to get. And this is one where, like, hey, the art is a particular style. Is that the style of art that you'd like? You can find out by looking in the sample. Otherwise, you wouldn't know. It's got cool little maps telling you about the locations that are here, a bunch of appendix maps and things like that, tavern dwellers and plot hooks, so you can see who's here. Looks really cool. And I like it because it's a very unique setting. It looks really, really neat. And I like it. So I have backed it myself, and I am looking forward to the final product. I have seen the work of Homie and the Dude before. I like it. And here you can see the link. So the link is available in the show notes, both on the podcast and on YouTube, if you want to check out the Wandering Tavern. It has 25 days to go as of this recording. By the time this comes out tomorrow, I think it's coming out tomorrow, it'll be 24, 23 days. So give it a look, take a look at the sample. And if you dig it, give them your support. Infestation at Devil's Glade is made by my friend Jeff Stevens. Jeff likes to make, I've worked with Jeff Stevens before on an adventure that we put out on the DM's Guild, one of the only adventures I have on the DM's Guild. The only adventure that's not a Adventurers League adventure, which was called Stars Over Stormwreck. Jeff is an excellent producer of small adventures that you can run for your 5e games. Infestation at Devil's Glade is one of these adventures. Infestation at Devil's Glade is going to be like a 35-page adventure, kind of similar to those old 32-page adventures we got in the old days, and it is all about a location that is getting infested by evil creepy crawly insects and stuff. So if you don't like creepy crawly insects, maybe you want to give this a pass, but if you're good fighting creepy crawly insects, this could be a good adventure for you. It is a very reasonable price. It is $5 for the PDF version of this adventure, $8 if you want access to the print on demand version. The print on demand version, you will still have to pay the cost of printing and shipping, but you, and then you pay the $8 to the Kickstarter to pay for the rest. So, and that gives you both the PDF and the ability to get the print-on-demand version through DriveThruRPG. It's all being fulfilled through DriveThruRPG. Now, Jeff Stevens doesn't have a sample available with one click on his site. However, I have seen many of his products in the past. I have written parts of the products that he has published in the past, and I can tell you that he knows how to produce an adventure. We don't have to get confirmation that he knows how to do this because he has many of them. In fact, you can pick up other add-ons of the different kinds of adventures that he has created in here. Jeff makes outstanding products, really, really fun, small, again, low, good low price product. There's a bunch of different versions for different tabletop VTTs. So you can get a Roll20 bundle, you can get a Shard bundle, and you can get the at-cost print-on-demand code as well. Looks really cool. I backed it. I'm eager to get it. I like fighting insect things. So looks really good. So that's Jeff Stevens' Infestation at the Devil's Glade. You can find a link to that in the show notes. My friend Joe over at Inkwell Ideas has a new backer kit crowdfunding campaign for Restless Encounters. Joe and Inkwell Ideas makes outstanding sets of decks, encounter decks, NPC decks. He's really, really good at building deck-based accessories for your tabletop role-playing games. I've got piles of them around here. I back all the Kickstarters for them. Really cool way of having quick encounters or quick NPCs. I love the NPC ones because you can show art of the NPC and they have a quick description of the NPC on the other side. And he came up with the idea of Restless Encounters. These are 50 encounter ideas when something gets in the way of a restful encounter during the night. So these are specifically encounters that occur while you're taking a rest. It has an entire encounter ideas, and he's got a one-click example where you can download the cards, 9 cards or so, where you can see what the encounter looks like. You can get the details of what happens during the encounter. Again, a little bit more information than what you would typically get just by rolling on a random encounter table. And some really neat stuff. So I think this is a very cool deck. This is also, these kind of crowdfunding campaigns are also a great way to get access to the other decks that Inkwell Ideas produces. So you want to check that out as well. Cool artwork, neat ideas, not all of them. Combat encounters, kind of interesting things that can occur when your characters are attempting to take a long rest. And what's cool about the card-based version is you can kind of just shuffle through them and pull one out and take a look at it and go, yeah, that makes sense. Or if you pull one out and you go, that one doesn't quite fit the situation that's going on here, you can pick which one you want, the Beast's Territory. So check out the sample. And if you like the work that you've seen from Inkwell Ideas for all the different decks that they have, you can check it out and pick up this deck and pick up other ones as well. So you can find a link to that in the show notes. That's Restless Encounters by Inkwell Ideas. In case you still have any money left over in your wallet, let's take a look at the 13th Age Mega Bundle. This is a bundle of holding available from Pelgrane Press for 13th Age. And this has come out from time to time. Every so often, they sort of bring these out again. I think this was back from December 20, but they're bringing it back. And for $20, you can get the core book, 13 True Ways, Bestiary 1, Bestiary 2, Book of Loot, The Loot Hoarder, The Book of Ages, Crown of Access, and a 13th Age GM screen and resource book. The resource book for the GM screen, by the way, is really, really good. $20 for all of those. But if you throw in more, and I think it's another $20 about, Threshold, which is at $40, you get the Book of the Underworld, the Book of Demons, Eye of the Stone Thief, a huge adventure, Shards of the Broken Sky, Elven Towers, Shadows over Illidan, High Magic and Low Cunning, The Crown Commands, Fire and Faith, Diamonds and Shadows. It is a huge bundle of 13th Age products that you can get in this one bundle. $40 for like PDFs is a little high, right? It feels high, but holy cow, it is hundreds of dollars worth of PDFs that you get. If you are interested in exploring 13th Age, and I highly recommend it. I love 13th Age. The one disclaimer I will give is I know that they're working on a second edition of 13th Age, but it hasn't even hit crowdfunding campaign status yet. They're not even yet funding the campaign status. But I know that Jonathan and Robert have both been working on a new version of 13th Age. They've been going through playtesting for it. It looks really cool. The good news is that it will be backward compatible. So even though you might get the new one and it replaces the 13th Age core book that you would get in this set, all of these other books will still work with the new edition. So you know that you're still future-proofed for all of these other books. It's only the 13th Age core book that's going to be changing, and we don't even know exactly when we're going to be getting that. So in the meantime, if you want to explore 13th Age, I would highly recommend this deal. Why would you want to explore 13th Age? All these great RPGs are out there. What does 13th Age have to offer that all of these other RPGs do not? 13th Age is Rob Hainsoe's and Jonathan Tweet's love letter to D&D. They both are longtime, long-term D&D producers. They both worked on Dungeons & Dragons. Jonathan Tweet worked on the third edition of Dungeons & Dragons. Robert Hainsoe worked on the fourth edition of D&D. I met Rob Hainsoe when he was working on fourth edition. I actually wrote stuff for 13th Age. I think I've got stuff in some of these books, I'm pretty sure. And they wrote a high power, high fantasy D20 RPG. So it has a very steep curve. If you look at like the shallow curve of fifth edition, this has a much steeper curve. It's got a lot of the best ideas of fourth edition brought into it, a lot of really good ideas from third edition and other versions of D&D in it. And it also has a heavy storytelling elements. It is the first game I have played that used abstract distances as the base amount of distance. It taught me how to do abstract combat and theater of the mind combat using a D20 based system. I really love this game. My friends really love this game. We ran a couple of different campaigns, two or three different campaigns in 13th Age, and I really, really loved it. It's an excellent RPG. It is definitely worth taking a look at, and I think that this isn't the best way to get involved and pick up 13th Age in order to see it is through this bundle of holding. So I would check this out. You can find a link to the 13th Age Mega Bundle in the show notes. Really good deal. Worth your $40. Like if you're interested at all in 13th Age and you want to learn more about it and you want all of these access to all of the different aspects of the world that are going on, you can't go wrong with this bundle of holding. Just in case you have a little bit more money left over, we have Dyson's commercial map packs. So Dyson Logos is my favorite source of maps for all of the RPGs that I run. I'm running Shadow Dark. I'm running 5th Edition. I'm running tons of stuff, and I'm always falling back to Dyson Logos maps. One of the wonderful things that Dyson does is he releases a good chunk of his maps. About, I think when you pick this up, it's roughly about 500 to 600 maps that are available under a commercial license, which means once you buy them, you can use them in your own adventures. You can use them in your own products that you want to sell yourself. If you are a GM who is starting to think about making some of your adventures available on the DMs Guild or on DriveThruRPG, I would recommend DriveThruRPG. Then, and you want some maps, you want to kind of save yourself a little bit because, you know, small publishing is hard, getting an audience is hard. You probably, if you actually commission a map, it's going to take you a fair bit of work to make back the money that it costs to commission a map. But Dyson has you covered with hundreds of maps available under the Dyson commercial map packs. They run from $10 to $20 a pack. Each one has a year's worth. I think the first pack one actually has all of his older maps from pre-2018. And then he has these yearly packs, 2018, 2019, 2020, 21, and 22 and 23, including a Compass Rose pack. So you can pick up these packs. They are $10 for all of the yearly packs, and then $20 for the pack one, which is a bunch of years in it. And I, even though I subscribe to Dyson's Patreon, and I do, and he gives away other commercial available maps there, I bought all of these as well because I use them in tools that I have created for patrons of Sly Flourish. I have the Dyson Logos tool, which lets you quickly select one of his commercially available maps on a big grid. You can select which one you want. Very easy to pick up. But if you are also a producer or you just want a bunch of his maps all like downloaded to your hard drive, this is a fantastic way to get big piles of Dyson Logos maps all available in a big zip file. They're all high resolution. Many of them include both gridded and ungridded versions. Some have like color versions and black and white versions, all different kinds of stuff that you can get by taking a look at Dyson Logos Commercial Map Pack. Please check it out. Please consider backing his Patreon. He is an incredible, just an incredible asset to the whole TTRPG industry. Thousands of maps he's created. I think the current map version has 1,300 maps available on his website, and like 600 of those are available with a commercial license so that you can use them in your own products. It's really, really excellent stuff. I have already talked about the Cairn 2 Kickstarter that's going on right now. They have 3,200 backers for Cairn 2. Cairn is a very lightweight, simple, kind of old school RPG. You can actually download a free version of it and check it out. And you should, because it's free. So why not check it out? But it's really, the Cairn 2, it has a box set at a very reasonable price. So one of the goals, one of the stretch goals, is the development of an online tool to help you build your character called Kettlewrite. Kettlewrite is a way to build characters either randomly or you can select things. It's got drag and drop. It's got all sorts of online tools. I've been hearing more people saying that if you're creating an RPG, you really need to have some kind of digital tool to help back it. I'm not crazy about that idea because those digital tools don't last. But here's the thing that really caught my attention, and it's the part at the bottom of this. They are going to release the entire builder as an open source project. So not only will the tool be available for you to use online, but I presume you will be able to go over to GitHub and fork it yourself and set it up if you needed to. Here's why this is important. One of the reasons that I'm always apprehensive about digital tools is I don't know when they're going to go away. If I have a big investment, not even just like in the material that I've got, but even if I have like a character builder and everyone is used to using the character builder and prefers the character builder, what I worry about is whether or not that tool is going to be around later. I don't really know. An example, and I kind of made fun of it, is Shadowdark has Shadow Darklings, right? So Shadowdark has Shadow Darklings. My players love Shadow Darklings. It's a really easy way that you can go. You can just like hit create. You can say, hey, I want to just use material from the core books. And you can say, design a character. And you get a character. Let's see. Let's roll random. We'll do a random best fit, generate a random character. Grom, the dwarf thief. And you get all the stats for Grom. You get the character options. You get what equipment, and you can hit print, and you've got your character ready to go. And we'll save a copy of Grom here. And you've got your copy of Grom. That's really, really great. And I love it. And I think it's outstanding. And I do know that you don't need this in order to make a Shadowdark character. The game itself is fully self-contained. But the one thing I worry about is like, yeah, but later on, where will this tool be? And I would love to see two different things with this tool. One is an ability to download the tool so you can run it locally. I would love, and I talked to the guy who made it, and he said that there's some kind of way that you could sort of encapsulate it and download it, and then you could have like your own local running version. But because it's a JavaScript-based app, I never know like what libraries it's reaching out to. Can you make a truly downloadable, self-contained version of this character builder? That would be one. Number two would be releasing the source code up on GitHub. Now, I know that in this case, because you're kind of like giving away all of the mechanics that are underlying the game, that's a big question about what you want to give away when you're making the tool available. But it makes me feel as a consumer of the game, if somebody's building a digital tool, I feel a lot better about that digital tool if I can either A, download it and save my own copy that I know will work even if the tool goes down, and or B, releasing that tool under an open source license, like up on GitHub, so I know that if I don't put it up there, someone else can still put up another copy if the game goes away, if something happens and the site is no longer up and running. I know that in the future, someone else can run that capability. So I was really happy to see that the Cairn Second Edition is taking their tool and making it available on open source, because it makes me feel as a consumer of this game. And by consumer, I don't just mean somebody that's buying it. I mean somebody that's really investing time and energy and effort and knowledge and all of the things that we invest when we buy an RPG, when we get into an RPG, and when we're running it with our friends. We have an investment in that RPG. It's something that we want to have for a long time. When I buy a physical book of an RPG, I feel really good about it. And I know that I can use that physical book to make characters, and it's not so hard. I feel really good because I know that book is not going anywhere. It takes a lot of effort to destroy a book. It doesn't take as much effort to destroy an online tool or a digital tool like that. So I'm very happy to see when somebody builds digital tools for their game, if they make those tools either downloadable and or open source, or ideally both, like saying, hey, we have the code is available open source, and we have a downloadable version that you can run locally without having to be online, then I feel really good about it. Another example of that is Albert Rodeo. Albert Rodeo 2.0 is a hosted platform, but 1.0 is now available as a downloadable. You can actually run it in a Docker. You can run it on a local machine. I have done so. So the old version of Owlbear is now out there as an open source tool that you can use. That's outstanding, right? That means that they've kind of said, hey, we know we may not be around forever, and we know people love the old one. Here's the old one, and it's available in open source. So I would implore independent publishers who are going through the effort of building online tools to consider making those tools open source and making downloadable versions of those tools, building those tools so that they can be downloadable. And I follow my own idea on this. The tools that I develop, my tools are not very complicated. They're like small JavaScript-based tools for like random generators, the 5e artisanal monster database, the Forge of Foes builder, and the Dyson map tool are like really the four big tools that I've developed for patrons of Sci Flourish. All four of those are downloadable. You can save them all. They either have a zip file that you can download and they're all sitting locally on your hard drive. They don't reach out to other libraries. You could disconnect your computer from the internet and still run them. Or that you can actually right-click and save as because it's just one HTML file. The Forge of Foes tool, for example, is a single self-contained HTML file. All the JavaScript is inside that HTML. If you save that page locally, you can then run it locally, and you have a little tool that helps you build monsters using the Forge of Foes stats. So I believe in that. Also, I think the source code behind all of those is up on GitHub as well, so that there's another way that people can reach the source code in order to get a lot of material. I don't think all of them are up on GitHub, but many of them are. So I thought that was a small thing that I thought was really worth discussing. Did you know I have another podcast? So I have a whole series of different podcasts. I have the Sly Flourish podcast, which includes both the Lazy GM Prep and the Lazy RPG Talk Show, which you're listening to now. I also have another podcast, another weekly podcast called Readings and Reflections. Readings and Reflections is a podcast in which I take the latest Sly Flourish article, I read it out loud so you can listen to it in your car instead of having to read it on the website, and then I do about a 5 or 10 minute discussion about what is behind the article, what was going through my mind, what other articles does it connect to, what are some of the other sort of background information. It's sort of the Sly Flourish director's cut. So if you really like the articles that I write, I hope you do, and I hope you subscribe to the newsletter where you can get them sent to your inbox, but you want a little bit more. You want to hear me talk to you about this article, kind of dive deep behind the article. What was going on in my head? What are some of the highlights I think are really important? You can get the Readings and Reflections podcast. This is available to patrons of Sly Flourish at the hero tier. So you can subscribe as a hero tier patron of Sly Flourish. Right now it is $4 to sign up, $4 a month to sign up as a hero. You get all of the access to all of the other stuff that I've been talking about for Patreon, but you also get access to this weekly. It comes out every Thursday evening. Is Readings and Reflections with Sly Flourish, where I talk about a Sly Flourish article and dive deep. They're about 10 to 12 minutes long, short podcasts. You can listen to them easily. They're designed for me to just, you know, as though I am sitting next to you in a nice leather-bound easy chair and we're talking about RPG stuff. It's a great way to kind of escape from everything else going on in the world and on in the day to kind of dive into a topic. I really enjoy doing it. It's a new weekly thing that I'm offering up there. You can subscribe. Once you go to your Patreon and become a hero tier subscriber, you will get a unique RSS URL that you can throw into your podcatcher of choice, whatever podcast app you use. You give it that direct feed, which is directly unique to you. You can also connect Spotify to Patreon, and there's instructions on how to do it with each episode so that you can listen to the same Readings and Reflections podcast in Spotify. So that way you can listen to it on whatever platform you enjoy listening to. Or you can also listen to it directly on Patreon. There's a little play button and you can hit play and sit back and have a nice beverage and listen to us talk about the latest Sly Flourish article. It's really fun to do, so I hope you'll check that out. That is the Readings and Reflections podcast, a feature for hero tier subscribers of the Sly Flourish Patreon. JP Covert, a really, really great producer of videos on YouTube talking about the TTRPG world, has done an excellent Best New Indie TTRPG Books video. 12-minute video where he talks about a number of different independently published RPGs that are not 5e, including Crown and Skull, Foundations, Cloud Empress, Table Titans Club, OSE Adventures Anthologies, Hand Games 21, and The Job. So you can check out this video. It is a really, really good look at so many different RPGs, what they mean, how they work, how they differ from one another, and which ones might be interesting for you. Check those out. Check out his video, Best New Indie TTRPG Books. You can find a link to that video in the show notes below. JP's stuff is really, really excellent. Give him a watch. And a subscribe, because it makes outstanding stuff. In Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, we have 8 steps for lazy GM prep. And one of the things you will notice is it kind of takes concepts that GMs typically package together into encounters, and it splits them all out into different parts. Today, we're going to talk about the advantage of splitting those things up. Why do we do that? What is it that makes it more flexible and makes it easier for us to improvise when we take components that are typically packed together and instead split them all out into different parts? So oftentimes when people are talking about their RPG prep or they're doing their prep, a very common way to do it is to build things out in encounters. I never really was crazy about the term encounters because I often thought about them as combat encounters, and I think sometimes people in their head get combat encounter and encounter different, even though an encounter is really like a talk with an NPC or a scene where you're doing exploration. I actually like the word scene a lot better. Scene works better. That you have a game, the game is broken out into scenes. And scenes can contain lots of different things. A scene can contain a location. They're obviously at a place in the world when they do a scene. A scene could include NPCs that they're talking to. A scene might include things that they can discover. What are some elements of discovery? Puzzles or traps or mosaics on the wall displaying information that they about something they didn't know about. A scene might include monsters that they're going to fight. A scene might include treasure. It could include all of these different things packaged together in scenes. So a very common way that GMs do their prep is they prep a scene. They say, okay, I have my starting scene, and then it might have a number of scenes that could occur, or maybe they're going to occur in sequence. You will also see published adventures that are built this way. Particularly procedural published adventures that are built around a story often take place with a series of scenes. Now, sometimes those series of scenes are kind of networked out. You know, if they choose one path, they'll go to one scene. If they choose another path, they'll go to another. But sometimes those scenes are linear. They go from one scene, they do some stuff, they go to the next scene, they do some stuff, they go to the next scene, they do some stuff. And the problem with the linear ones is they can feel, I don't want to use the R word, but they can feel a little railroady. It kind of doesn't matter what choices the characters are making. They're still going from one scene to another. Now, sometimes that's just the way the story works out. Sometimes that works out well for an adventure. I loved the adventure Light of Xeraxis. This is the adventure that's part of the Spelljammer box set for Wizards of the Coast. I ran the adventure and I liked it a lot. And it is a very procedural scene-based adventure. You know you're going from point A to point B to point C to point D. The whole book is kind of laid out that way. Scene, 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 scene. And not a lot of like open world exploration stuff that you can find in other adventures. Adventures like Tomb of Annihilation or Curse of Strahd have you kind of going from place to place. And it's still a little scene-based. Like once you go to a particular place, then you have a location, you have NPCs, you have things that you discover, you have treasure that you pick up, you have monsters that you pick up. They're all kind of built together. But when we're doing our prep, one of the things that's really important for us, one of the elements that really matters that I've kind of talked about with many hundreds of DMs, I've surveyed thousands of DMs and gotten lots of feedback on this, and a couple of truths had come out of those conversations. One of the truths were that many times the less prep GMs did, the better the game went. And other ones are that the kind of tools that help GMs the most are the ones that help them improvise. And these are really two interrelated ideas. That when you're running a game, giving yourself the ability and the freedom to improvise and still have the things that you need to build a rich game are more valuable than when you've kind of locked yourself into, well, a scene is going to be a particular scene that's going to lead to a next scene. And these are all the things that are in the scene and I can't change them and I can't really move them because they're all built together. So when I was designing the 8 steps for Return, one of the things I did is I essentially took all of the components that you typically had for a series of scenes, and I took a hammer and I shattered them and they exploded outwards. And instead of having all of those scenes where you have a particular scene that has NPCs that are in the scene, you have things that you could discover in the scene, you have a location where the scene is taking place, you have a treasure that the characters might acquire should they accomplish something in the scene, and they have monsters they might fight in the scene. Instead, we broke all those out into separate components. So that's why in the 8 steps, we have like the strong start, we have secrets and clues, we have locations, we have monsters, we have NPCs, and we have treasure, and they're all split apart from the rest of it. Now, we do have a section in one of the steps, step 2 of the 8 steps is scenes. But the scenes that we have there are not these big, fully fledged balls that have all of the components to them. The scenes that we have there are really just an outline of the things that might happen. Sometimes they're just one or two sentences. There were one or two words. They're probably no longer than a sentence. And they're usually just a few words. And it's usually just a bullet list of here are the things that might happen. Or here are some of the decisions that need to be made by the characters. Or here are some of the options for the next game that are going to come up. And what I've talked about before is that Scenes is really a catch-all for lots of different things, including hooks, including future choices that are being made, including forks that the characters might follow through. So Scenes can really encapsulate a lot of different things. And sometimes you might have hardly anything. For example, here is an example of the notes that I have for a game that I'm literally running in about an hour. And I have Scenes, and I have two things in there. Encounter at Old Grigor's Hut, which is already the secret and clue. Which is already the strong start, so I probably don't even need it there. And then the real scene is traveling to the Vile Well. That I'm going to have a series of stuff that's going to occur in Dremel and the Vile Well. I don't need a lot because I have everything else. So what are those different components that we have, right? And those are the other parts of the eight steps. Not all eight steps, because sometimes we have some other things, but secrets and clues are abstracted from the scenes. We don't know which scenes that those secrets and clues are going to get revealed. We don't know the fantastic locations. We have a list of locations, maybe we have a map, but we keep the physical location abstracted from the NPCs, from monsters, from treasure, and from secrets, because that way, when the characters go to a location, at the moment in the game, we can decide what monsters make sense given the situation or given the pacing of the game. Is there an NPC here? Again, based on situation or based on the pacing of the game, do we want to have an NPC that they meet with instead of having another fight? Do we want to drop treasure in here? Does it make sense that treasure would be found in this place? Does it make sense that given the current situation that treasure would be found here? So we separate all of those things out so that way you can build the scenes at the table. Again, that focus of preparing to improvise. What are the things that we want to have on hand that help us build the story as it goes? What this enables for us is that we can decide based on what the characters are doing, based on the decisions that the players are making, we can decide which components we want to drop into a particular scene right when we have it. And we still have those components. They're already pre-cooked. They're already ready to go. We know what monsters might be available. We know what treasure we might pick up. We know what NPCs we might drop in. We know what secrets and clues they might pick up. And we can decide at the moment, this is the one we want to drop here, drop this in, drop this in. We've done some pre-work to help us build those scenes. Some GMs are so good that they don't even need to do that, that they can just literally improv everything as they sit down and go. They can take stuff from the players. They can build locations on the fly. But I think a lot of GMs, myself included, I need something. I need some good prompts. I need some little bit of homework that I've done to give me an idea about what these locations are like or what some of these secrets are going to be that they could learn, or a little bit about the NPCs, the name of the NPCs, some of their mannerisms, some goals about what they want, maybe an archetype from popular fiction that I can use to roleplay that character. So we want to separate all these out, but there's a really distinct reason why all of these components are split out from one another and that we're preparing them separated from one another. And that's because we're focused on this idea of preparing to improvise, that our goal is to build scenes as they make sense, as they occur during the game, from all of these little components that we've prepared ahead of time. So it's really the benefit of both worlds. We have a benefit of the flexibility of being able to think on our feet and building scenes during the situation, but we've already done our homework to build out some of the important secrets and clues, clarifying what they are, why they're important, why they're there, who the monsters are, what monsters make sense given the situation. We can even build little tables of those monsters if we want to build a real random, maybe we roll randomly to determine or maybe we pick a monster based on the situation that's going on. Same thing with NPCs. We've done a little bit of pre-chewing on those NPCs so we know who they are. We just don't know necessarily that they're going to show up in one scene or the other. So that's really why we break up all of these different components that you would typically find in scenes in RPGs. That if you're used to preparing your game by building out individual scenes that have NPCs, the location, monsters, treasure, and information the characters might discover, and you're used to having in this block, consider shattering the block. Consider breaking those pieces out across your whole session, and instead having secrets, monsters, NPCs, locations, and treasure that are split apart from one another so that you can pick from the different pieces as you need them when you're building out the scenes for the game you're running. Every month on the Sly Flourish Patreon, we do Patreon questions. We have a Patreon Q&A. I post a new thread at the beginning of each month Patrons of Sly Flourish can ask any RPG-related question that they have. I answer every question on the Patreon. We now have a Patreon Q&A database, so you can search previous questions to find what other people have asked over the past few years that we've been doing this. Some of those questions make their way to the talk show here, where we talk about it on the talk show. Other ones actually become the catalyst for other videos or articles in the future. Cameron H. says, after the completion of my second pre-written module, I'm looking to start my own homebrew campaign. Something I'm not completely clued up on is the pacing of level increases. Do you have a general rule of thumb for how often PCs should level? For reference, I'm planning on running weekly sessions of 3 hours with 4 to 5 players. I wasn't sure if there was a general rule that someone had written out, such as level 2 after one session, level 3 after 2, etc. I don't know that there is a clear written amount of levels, amount of sessions that you should play between levels. And I know that different D&D designers have described different ways of doing it. I don't recall anything being written in the Dungeon Master's Guide about it. And nothing is jumping out at me from like Level Up Advanced 5e or other 5e variants that talk about how often you should level. But I do have advice. One is that I generally come up with a reason for them to level after the first session, that getting from level 1 to level 2, it's not a big deal to have them make that jump pretty quickly. I think only if I had players who were really new, and only if I was running an adventure that fit level 1 characters particularly, and remember, level 1 characters are extremely fragile, I would try to get them to second level as much as possible. My joke is that you should have a stern conversation and a fight with a giant rat, and then you should be level 2. So consider getting them to level 2 quickly. It is not uncommon for me for characters to get to second level after our session 0. So we'll run a session 0, we'll talk about the game, I'll run one little intro encounter, and then they'll hit level 2. And then it's level 2 on from that standpoint. If your players are experienced, they're probably not going to mind that at all. They'll be happy to get to level 2 as fast as possible. Level 2 characters are not really that much more complicated than level 1 characters are, but they're definitely more robust. They're definitely more resilient. Their hit points are going up by like 60 or 70%. So level 1 to level, there's no jump in power greater than going from level 1 to level 2. That is by far the most power the characters gain in any level, any jump of any level in the game. Maybe you could argue level 4 to level 5. Level 4 to level 5 is really, really big too. But just in sheer hit point volume, you get many more percentage of hit points higher going from level 1 to 2. So then when you think about level 2 and onward, generally speaking, I would say every 2 to 3 sessions is a good rate. My recommended way of leveling is what we call like event-based leveling. Sometimes people get that confused with milestone leveling. The DMG has kind of confusing descriptions of what milestone leveling is that's different than event-based leveling. So I'm going to call it event-based leveling. But essentially, they accomplish something. The players accomplish something in the world, and the thing that they accomplish gains them a new level. Fighting a particular boss and beating that boss. Recovering an artifact that they've been hunting for. Accomplishing some other kind of goal that's part of it. Now, you don't have to define what all of those goals are ahead of time. Instead, once they hit one level, you might want to think about what the accomplishment is that they're going to achieve that gets them to the next level. You might not know it right away. It might not be until the players decide upon a particular course of action. Once they've decided on that course of action, then you can say, okay, the next level that they're going to acquire is going to be on the completion of that course of action. Now, this might mean that sometimes they might go a few sessions without leveling, and other times they might accomplish something a lot and level really quickly. My wife reminded me that in my Empire of the Ghouls game, we went from level 12, took many, many sessions, and then they accomplished a big goal and they got to 13, and then 2 sessions later, they got to 14. So, and it was because they streamlined their path. They knew where they were going to go, they picked the thing, and it wasn't that far away, and they made that big accomplishment. And I don't think that's actually a bug. I think that that's a feature. The idea that sometimes leveling doesn't, there isn't a clear pacing of leveling. You don't have to maintain a perfect every 2 or 3 sessions. Sometimes they might go 4 or 5 sessions, and then sometimes it might be 2 sessions tied really closely together. So I recommend milestone leveling. I'm sorry, event-based leveling. Build leveling around events that occur in the game. I really like the idea of having the players sort of define what the goal is, and then you kind of tap the level onto that goal. And I would say roughly 2 to 3 sessions for leveling, like maybe up to tier 2 or 3, and then you might squeeze it out to 3 or 4 sessions. But again, focus more on what's going on in the story, tie leveling to the events that are occurring in the story, and it should go fine. Dank Meme says, I was in a situation where I'd been running games for a long while, but after the last few years, a couple of friends decided to take over running games because DMing seemed interesting to them. The campaign is coming to a close and it's going to be my turn to run again. I'm getting hot feet and I want to start doing prep ahead of time. There's the obvious challenge of not knowing the characters yet. However, I was planning on running the campaign in the Southlands of Midgard while utilizing the World Book. Do you have any suggestions for how best to spend the next few months on the DM side? This probably goes against some sort of lazy principles, but I was wondering if you had any advice for how you would prepare the campaign if you had several months to prepare it instead. What would you be looking to comb from the source book, and how much or what would you actually prepare? First of all, this absolutely fits in with lazy GMing style. Lazy GMing style is all about efficiency, and what are the things that you can prepare when you have this amount of time? That is a great gift. You have a lot of time to think about and prepare the right kind of stuff. So we're going to talk really quickly about what do I consider to be the elements that are going to help you the most, and then what are some things that GMs sometimes prepare that aren't really that helpful. So we're going to talk about both of those. First, on the one side, you know your campaign setting, Southlands, and you know that you're going to be in Midgard. Those are two books. That's 1,000 pages worth of material between the Midgard World book and the Southlands book that you can dive into over months. And that's just awesome. Like being able to dive into those two setting books, understand a lot about Midgard, know about all of the different regions, know about the big politics that are going on the global scale, know about all that stuff, and then dive deep into the Southlands because you know it's going to be there, and you have a whole other book about the Southlands to run. The kinds of things that you want to look for while you're going through it are, what are the plot ideas of the larger world that you think would be fun for the characters to get involved in? What are the regions of those world and what's going on in those regions? What are interesting locations that you might want to highlight so that the character, you can bring them into your campaign and think about, oh yeah, it'll be really fun for them to go to this particular location. You can drop those in. Just ideas and concepts, monsters, NPCs, factions, old secrets, gods, history. There's so much stuff in those books, and you have the time. This is, a lot of times people don't have this kind of time to be able to dive into the source material. Just reading it takes a long time. What I suggest is, like, get a highlighter and highlight the stuff in the book. Write notes in the margins of the book of the things you think are really interesting. My wife yelled at me about this. She's like, oh God, don't write in the book. I am a believer in writing in our books, and I'll tell you why. It is not your job to preserve a pristine copy of the Midgard World Book. There are many thousands of them out there, but yours is just for you. And when you write your notes in there, when you highlight stuff, now that book went from being an artifact that there are thousands of copies of to an artifact that there is only one copy of. And I'll ask you this, if you could get your old uncle's D&D stuff and it had all of his notes in there, would you rather have that or a copy, on the assumption that it wasn't worth thousands of dollars if it was pristine? Answer is probably going to be you'd want the one with the notes because it's got all your crazy uncle's notes in there. So go ahead and write in your book. But if you really don't want to write in the book, you're like, God, no, Mike, I can't do it. Then take notes separately. Write notes, put sticky notes in there, and write ideas down. Mark the pages where you've got stuff. Put those little bookmarks all through it of different things that you want to find. And just dive into the setting. Dive into the lore. Dive into the gods. Dive into the political machinations that are going on. Dive into the locations. Dive into all that stuff, the history of it. You know, it's fantastic for you to be able to kind of really dig into this and really absorb that. So focus on that stuff. When you're thinking about the campaign itself, thinking about your major plot line, what your elevator pitch is going to be, what the big focus is, what are the truths of your campaign that's separate from the truths of Midgard, right? What are the things that your campaign is going to focus on? You can start to think about that. You can start to think about the big political powers that are going to be involved. But here's what not to focus on. Don't focus on the decisions of the characters or the path that they're going to take. Don't focus on thinking about what they're going to do or I wouldn't even really outline the campaign. I would not have sort of the A, B, C, D steps of what the arc of the campaign is going to be. You can think about what that initial situation is. You can think about, like, what their initial involvement is going to be. And you can think about the larger picture of what's happening in the world. But I would not draw a path. I would not build an outline. Instead, the outline is going to occur while you're actually running the game. But you can dive really deep into all of the other aspects. And the more of that you've taken in and internalized, the more ideas you've got in your head, the more you're fueling yourself to be able to build that story with your players when you're actually running the campaign. So I think it is absolutely valuable for lazy DMs to read the material that they're going to run. And if you have that kind of time, if you have months, there's a lot you can do by studying that world and just living in it. Just go to Per Bastet, close your eyes and imagine what it's like walking around the city of cats and all of those huge monuments and the ziggurats that are there and the warring gods and on the big sand ships and all the stuff. And just imagine being there and take the ideas from your imagination as you're there and write them in your notes and get ideas for them and think about like, oh, that weird crack in the tomb that's going down, you know, in the depths below that nobody's been to for a while. It's filled with undead cat folk. Right. There's so many cool things that you can do. You can also kind of build out like specific locations, your dungeons. What are the maps for the dungeons? What are the things you're going to do there? Hit your Dyson logos maps and pick out maps that fit those dungeons. Think about kind of what's going to go on there, but don't get too heavily invested in trying to build out the path that the characters are going to take. You almost want to remove the characters completely from your thoughts. Don't think about them. I know typically it's like, hey, put the characters right in the center. But as you say, you don't know who the characters are. So they're not in the center yet. Instead, we're focused on the world. We're focused on the regions. We're focused on the situation that's going on there. Imagine what's happening in this place without the characters. And then we drop them in. And then we get to see the world from the perspective of the characters. I think that could work really, really well. Chris W. says, loved episode 637. I have a 637 on challenge ratings. You put a lot of content out about CR, building monsters, balancing encounters, spells, abilities have significant impact on CRs. I feel like we are missing the second half of the equation, which is determining the party's APL. That's average party level. The DMG would have you add the PC's level and divide it by the number of players, but I see a significant disparity between players depending on their character's focus. What are your thoughts on how I can measure the functional APL of two very different parties when trying to balance encounters using the CR guidelines you've already laid out? For example, in one campaign I'm running, I have a newish player with AC 14 doing an average of 20 damage per round, and another min-max player with an AC of 19 doing 50 damage per round. Both are level 6 with limited magic items using WotC content, but one is 25% harder to hit and does 2.5 times the damage. It's easy to see a party of min-maxers will stand up differently than a party of new players to the same CR, but have the same APL according to the DMG. I expect a greater disparity as we incorporate the 2024 edition into play. You're probably correct. I would not worry too much about APL at all. So an important consideration when we're talking about the lazy encounter benchmark, and if you want to learn more about the lazy encounter benchmark, my simple tool for helping you gauge roughly how hard an encounter might be and whether that encounter might be deadly, you're essentially coming up sort of with an APL. Instead of an APL, you're actually just adding all the character levels together. So it sort of doesn't matter if there's a disparity in character levels. That's one of the advantages of the lazy encounter benchmark, is that you can have characters of different levels and monsters of different CRs and any number of monsters and any number of characters, and the equation still works. It fits, it scales with all of that. But it's not perfect either, because it doesn't know things like what you know, that you have one character who's basically, we'll say, roughly two times the equivalent of the other character. Instead of worrying about APL, and when we're building out encounters and thinking about encounters for our own game, we can kind of throw a lot of that out. And instead, we can just say, well, I know that this character is more powerful, so I'm just going to up the ante. I'm going to up the encounter benchmark. An easy way to up the encounter benchmark, and we talk about this in Forge of Foes, is to pretend you have another character of the same level. So if you have one character who's basically twice as effective as other characters, pretend there's another character. If you have 5-6 level characters, but one of them is hitting like a freight train and is really hard to hit, pretend it's 6. And you can just increase the benchmark. The nice thing about increasing the benchmark like this horizontally, essentially by adding more characters, instead of increasing the character's level, is that you're not going to have these big jumps like you will at from 4th to 5th and 10th to 11th and 16th to 17th, because we have tier jumps in the lazy encounter benchmark, particularly the 4th to 5th level tier jump is really big. You're essentially doubling the amount of monsters that are required for something to be deadly. So you don't want to pretend they're a level higher. Instead, you want to pretend that there are more characters, and that scales really well because it increases the amount in a smaller way. It basically says 5th to 6th is only like a, what is that? Is that a 20% increase? So it's like roughly a 20% increase in the amount of levels, which moves your monster maximum CR up just a little bit. But we don't have to worry about APL. And if you're using, I'm going to offer you the advice that I've got based on the tools that I use. So I'm not really going to talk about APL as much and what you can do there. But generally, I think that that probably works in other avenues too. That if you essentially see a really powerful character early on, for example, you might have a moon druid, right? A circle of the moon druid. And the circle of the moon druid, because they can transform into a bear, has so many extra hit points and does so much more damage that it's really like having two other characters. It's almost like they're double the amount of power. So what you do is you just pretend you have another character. And if you do the math by pretending there's an additional character, the benchmark goes up, and then you have a better gauge of, okay, here's where it's going to go. But again, don't build all your encounters around one particular challenge level. Don't just assume you always have to be threatening the characters. Make sure to run easy fights. Make sure that the characters might see fights or get in engagements where they know that they're going to be outclassed. The game, the world does not transform to the level of the characters, right? Sometimes, but it's always good to have that benchmark in mind. That's why we have it. We have the benchmark so that you can have a rough gauge of like, okay, I know if I have 5-6 level characters, that the benchmark was 2.5. Let's do the math in our head. 5-6 level characters, 5 times 6 is 30. Half of that is 15. You know that you have about 15 CRs worth of monsters would be difficult. But because you know your characters are really powerful, you have this extra person, you treat it as 6. So instead, it's 18. So now you have 18 CRs worth of monsters, might be potentially deadly for a group of 5-6 level characters, for your group of 5-6 level characters. So you have that CR 18. Doesn't, and of course, you don't want to have a monster that's any more than 150% of the character level. So you don't want to have a monster with a CR more than 9, maybe 10, right? Because you get a little tougher, so you can beat the 10. But that way it gives you a CR mix and you're like, okay, now I know roughly how many CRs of monsters I could throw at the characters before it turns deadly. And of course, you could run easier fights. And of course, you could run hard fights, but you probably want to give them some advantage. So hopefully that gives you a little idea. The main tip you want to pick up here is if you find that players are particularly powerful for their level, just pretend there's one more of them. And a lot of the math that you can use to scale up your encounters works fine. Friends, I hope you enjoyed our show today. I know I did. If you like this show and you want more stuff like this from me, please consider subscribing to the Sly Flourish newsletter. It is absolutely free to sign up. You can find a link in your show notes, both on the podcast and on the YouTube video. All you have to do is give your email address and you get a weekly RPG-related email sent directly to your inbox, along with links to all of the other material I put out there. You can also join the Sly Flourish Patreon. If you join at the Hero tier, you get the Readings and Reflections podcast. You also get access to all kinds of tools, tips, tricks, adventures, all kinds of stuff you get for being a patron of Sly Flourish. It's a really, really good deal. And you can pick up my books, including Forge of Foes, Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, The Lazy DM's Companion, The Lazy DM's Workbook, and all the fantastic adventure books available in the Sly Flourish bookstore. Thank you all so much. Have a great day and get out there and play an RPG.